Hi there, and welcome to another episode of Horse Sense, a show for you, the thinking horse person. At Horse Sense, we give you practical, relevant, up-to-date, and even inspirational information that enriches your horsing life. This show is brought to you by the Equine Care Clinic, a clinic dedicated to the care of sick or injured horses when their owners are unable to. Check out the site at equinecareclinic.com for lots of really cool information and products. I'm your host, Amanda Edwards, and this week I'm talking to Barbara Padolino. Barbara is currently a PhD candidate at the University of Sydney, undertaking a research project looking at better ways to transport horses and keep them safe and happy. She's got a real love of horses and she loves looking at horse behaviour. She's been a breeder, she's a vet, so she's got a real passion for it. I think this is a really important piece of work, particularly in Australia where distance is often part of our horsing experience. And there's some really great hints and tips in this interview. Welcome to Horse Sense, Barbara. How are you this morning?
Fine, thank you. And you?
Okay. I'm really great. Yeah, it's fantastic to be here. So we'll start off with the first question. What do you do and why do you do it?
I'm doing a PhD on the implication for horse health and welfare arising from transportation right now at the University of Sydney. And I basically am a equine horse vet with a great passion in horse behavior and welfare. So I end up to study and shift to the academics life because as a vet and also as a rider and breeder, I got difficult cases connected with transportation.
And as we all do.
And often, you know, my question was, what happened inside the track? Why these horses get so sick? And then, you know, as a vet, I also traveled a lot inside the trailer, you know, when I got falls with problem, and I realized it was really a stressful situation for them. And then, I decided, okay, I need to study to have this reply for my questions and see if I can do something to improve the welfare of the traveling horse.
That's fantastic. So you're obviously not from Australia.
Yeah.
How do you come to be in Australia? Where have you come from?
I'm from Italy, and I am also a lecturer at the Department of Veterinary Medicine of the University of Bari. And as you know, if you want to be in the academics, you really need to speak English. I realized that an experience in a English native country could be good for me.
That's great.
Yeah, I contracted 3 years ago Professor Paul McGreevy, and I asked to him if I could come to Australia to work with him, and he said, yes, I have a project for you. And so I come 3 years ago to work with him on a project about horse training in the round pen. And when I was here, I met another lecturer, Pietro Celi, and he just proposed me to come to do a PhD here. And so he advised me to apply for an international scholarship. And I wrote this proposal about transport stress in horses, and I got a scholarship, and that's it.
That's fantastic. And so did you, as a young girl, did you grow up riding horses in Italy? And so you obviously, it's been a passion of yours. How did that passion start?
My mom always says to me that it's a genetic disease. It's not a passion. just because, you know, like my grandfather and my father love horses. So I think I took this passion from them, and then I asked father to buy a horse for me when I was only 12 years old. Then I started as rider, you know, I have done jumping.
Yep.
Then a race track was open close to my farm, so then I start going regularly to work at the horse track as a groomer with the tractor.
Okay, yeah.
So then I become driver.
Fantastic.
And then I graduated in vet medicine and I start be a breeder, and you know, I opened my breeding center. I have done, you know, reproduction and artificial insemination in horses for a while. And it's a disease. So, you know.
It is. And it's good to know that that's a worldwide disease, because I think every, my mum rode, and, you know, same for me, you know, it just gets, once it gets in your blood, that's it, you're stuck.
Yeah, you know, I have been like owner of more than 20 horses, you know.
Yes. And why is it that you can never have just one?
It's just because then you start, and then, you know, you like the babies, and, you know, and
exactly. And they're so cute. And oh, look at that one over there. Yeah, I know the feeling. You know, we started with, we've got a very small herd at the moment. We're with six. And I'm feeling very pleased with myself because I have 100 acres, and I'm thinking I could have more.
Yeah, exactly. Then, yeah, the problem is, you know, I was also breeding and raising, so then, you know, you also have to sell sometimes.
You do, and that's awful. So I hate that bit. So I've tried to keep it small in number.
Yeah, exactly. Because then, yeah, when you start to having more, then become like a kind of business, and
you have to, it gets it's that flick between, okay, my passion might have just overrun me.
Yeah. So like my dad, like, because, you know, to be over now more than 20 horses, I had to work really hard as a vet.
Then
my dad just always said, just try to sell some horses, and then you probably will have more free time.
Exactly. But then what do we do with our free time? We spend it with horses.
My free time was, you know, be anywhere at the racetrack.
So you've brought your family over to Australia to do your research?
My son is with me. So,
yep.
I got separated after when he was born, and
you and him, that's great. Yeah. So is he enjoying Australia as well?
Yeah, he's becoming a little horsey, likes barbecue sauce, you know. So
excellent, keeping up the tradition. Yeah. All right, so tell the listeners a bit about what your research, how you're conducting the research.
Yes. The PhD is structured like in three parts so far. Mm-hmm. So one is actually about collecting data on how people manage transportation and which problem they usually have. So I conducted this comprehensive survey on transport practice and issues.
I think that's where I saw you. It was the survey was out there.
And it was actually a really nice experience, and I collected close to 1,000 replies.
That's a really good cohort, really, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it just, you know, it confirms that people are interested in transportation, and they want to know, you know. More than 150 people send me an email. So, you know, because the survey was anonymous, they don't care about the anonymous stuff, but they ask it just about the results. So people want to know how transport should be managed. Now I have analyzed all this data, and I'm going, I hope, to write some article. And, yes, this is a kind of one will be just a descriptive study where, you know, we just report what people really do and which issue they got. And then I have analyzed, like, if there is an association between some practice and the possible disease. And, and then some risk factors. So I have, like, cases. So I'm going to analyze if, you know, the breed or the age of the animal can be a predisposition factor, or, like, you know, the journey duration. And a similar study was just accepted that is going to be published this week, and where we have analyzed, like, risk factor during a longer trip from Perth to Sydney, that, like, in Australia seems to be
That's the biggest one. Oh, well, actually, it's probably it's probably one of the biggest ones.
But it's I spoke with people from Western Australia, and they explained me that in a sense, lots of the major equestrian show happen, like, on the other coast, so they actually have to travel regularly. And, you know, the inter-school competition or some big competition at the end of the day are based more, like, in New South Wales or Victoria. And also, like, you know, for the racing, the big sales are like Brisbane, Sydney, and Melbourne. So, you know, people have to travel.
That's exactly right. And there are, that would be a very good group of horses to study, and also I expect that the owners and trainers have developed ways to minimize adverse outcomes.
There are, like, also, like, transport company which are specialized, like, in these long hauling, but still, you know, we can do better, you know?
Absolutely.
And, I mean, so as I told you, so the first part of the PhD is just collecting data. The second part is more experimental. So, and then I've studied actually the effect of 8 hours transportation on physiology, behavior, and the clinical parameter. And
oh, that will be interesting as well. What great interesting bits of work.
So it's like I have watched, like, video of horses, you know, being in a track for 8 hours.
That must have been exciting watching for you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's, I think that, you know, if you can read the body language of the horse, you can understand a lot. So I'm trying to see if I can develop, like, an easy ethogram that people can use during travel to understand if the horse is getting more stressed, you know? And so,
and so are you going to, is a piece of that work going to be around actually monitoring horses in those long haul trips and recording? Because now with telemetry, we can do a lot of stuff where we do, you know, clinical monitoring, those clinical parameters.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I have, like, some data of horses after actually this long trip from Perth to Sydney, and I'm trying to organize actually an experiment where I travel with them, so that I can actually have, you know, really good parameter. I understand what's happened. Also, at the rest stop, because, you know, during this long trip, horses anyway stop in stable, understand if they get also stressed from the new environment, and how actually we can make this a rest stop also more useful for them, and not actually an adding stress. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly. That's, very, I'm so interested in this bit of research. I think it's amazing and well overdue. So I'm very pleased to have found you. So some of the things that you've found from your first survey, what were some of the problems that came up that people identified?
There is still lots of behavioral problem, in particularly at loading. And so Now I'm trying to analyze if there is actually an association in the way how people load animals, and if we can actually propose some training method which can be really helpful to avoid behavior problem and also injuries, because you know when the horse starts refusing to load, sometimes there are also injuries to the horse and to the handler, you know, ropes, hands, and you know, but also, sometimes also worse problem. And then,
and I think that comes back to your point of the behavior of the horse. We've for a very long time, particularly, I don't know about other countries, but in Australia, we've tended to go, you know, the horse must do what I say it should do. And so we force them in some ways. We put them into a small confined space, which is very non-horse-like.
Yeah.
And we say to them, stand there very still. And that's not normal either, because a horse is a continually moving animal. And then we ask it, and then we shut it in and we trap it.
Yeah.
And I think that those all already put stress on a horse, and if it has any underlying conditions, those are exacerbated by that stress.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah, transport stress just bring all the problems which are probably already inside. But, you know, with disease, we are usually able to balance, you know, you have a bacteria, but your immune system actually can stop the bacteria, and you don't get sick.
Yes.
But when you get stressed, your immune system is affected, and then this is why we develop disease related to stress. And just transport stress just make that. And this is why it's really important to minimize the stress during the transport. And
I love that you're taking it right back to that point, because I have a trainer that I work with who absolutely, he fixes a lot of float problems, and he is an amazing horseman, Steve Brinkworth. And he just really, his whole thing is, no, we're not going to trap that horse in there. We're going to make that place a safe place, and he's going to enjoy being in there. So that when he's in there, he's relaxed and he's calm, and he won't shut the back of the float until that horse is standing in there, clearly relaxed, calm, and very happy to be there.
You know, and with horse training, it's just timing. You know, you have to, you know, to reward the right behavior. So, you
that's
know,
that's exactly right.
So, and with horses, it's really important, the communication. I mean, as a vet, as a breeder, whatever, I really think that you need to understand horse language. I mean, when, you know, I do lecture in Italy about horse handling, I always make this example. I mean, if I come to Australia, I have to learn English. If you want to work with horses, you have to study horse language.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more, Barbara. That's brilliant. So getting back to the other problems that came up, so there's obviously the loading problem and the stress that causes.
Yeah, and the
disease. So talk about disease.
So we have injuries that can happen, you know, just related to behavioral problems, but sometimes also are related with poor vehicle design or driving skills, you know, turning, and then the horses cannot really keep his balance or fall down and get injured. And then we have also, you know, mainly respiratory or gastrointestinal problems. So it's a you know, the gas system and the respiratory system are usually the more affected by transport stress. So, you can have just little stuff, just like increasing of mucus, or, you know, inflammation of the upper airways, but also like pneumonia. So I think your travel sickness is the term here in Australia.
Yeah, that's what we call it, travel sickness.
And so, but I mean, the term is like equine transport pneumonia. And this can be actually also fatal if you don't pick the disease soon. So it's really...
Well, that's true. So, and I think that that's what probably you've seen over the long haul things, and I have too, is that they arrive and there is, you know, they started off and good horse companies, truck companies won't transport a horse with a runny nose, like, because by the end of it, that runny nose has turned into full on pneumonia or,
yeah,
you know, pooling or some kind of, and they're dead.
Yeah.
So,
yeah. So, yeah, then one key point that I think I'm going to demonstrate also with the experiment which I've done is that the preloading health status is really important. So horses which have already like subclinical disease, light inflammation, yep, of the respiratory system are going to become worse.
Yep.
And, you know, this is common knowledge, but the problem is that you need to demonstrate with number and then also explain to the people. So my point now is not only doing this a nice, you know, PhD interesting for me, but also going to educate people. I think the really point is, you know, just educate all the horse people about what's best practice during transportation are, and
yep,
and explain them in lie language or, you know, with
yep,
picture or whatever. Because, I mean, you know, if I do a nice research and then I publish in a really high-level impact factor journal, no one will read it.
No, that's right, exactly, and I couldn't agree more. It's why I try to write a lot in magazines that people read, because I want people to know.
Yeah, and then, you know,
easy things that can make a big difference.
And the point, you know, like for instance, now in Europe, usually, if for instance for dog, if you want to be a dog owner, you have to take a kind of license. So, you know, before like become a owner, there is someone who teach you about dog and about how you should handle dog, and you know, this is a general rules. And in the UK actually they do the same. I mean, if you want to become a horse person, then you need to have at least a certificate in horse handling skill. So I think this is really important, and it's the only way how to start safeguard horse welfare. It's just if the people around horses
absolutely
have a background.
And I pick up your point before where you said it, you know, a lot of this is common knowledge. It's actually not as common as you might think. People in Australia, there is a lot of distance between one point and another, and if they haven't done that long haul travel, even a few hours, they don't have any understanding that horses die in floats. I've had one horse die. I transport a lot of horses, and I'm picking up a lot of sick and injured horses, and I try very hard not to take them very far. But one of my things is to do that incredibly carefully. But I've had a healthy horse die in a float, and that was years ago, and it was a huge shock to me. Like I didn't know. And when the people came to take the body away, they said, oh, this happens all the time. And I was so surprised. I just didn't know that.
Yeah, I collected lots of this kind of problem with the surveys. And like horses just found that in the track, or found that like in a paddock one day after the trip. And, you know, and this is sad. And so this is why we need to work all together to improve the situation. Yeah. So, you know,
exactly.
And that's a point, you know. And I mean, all of us love horses. And, you know, from the racing to the pleasure horses, all of us want having the best for our horses.
Yeah.
So, you know.
Yeah. So tell me, the other thing that as part of sometimes gets wrapped up into travel sickness is the gut problems that you mentioned. And so salmonella
enterocolitis, yeah.
Yeah. Tell our listeners about that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the enterocolitis is anyway like an inflammation of the gut. And usually there is like e bacteria such as Salmonella or Clostridium or Fusarium that become predominant in the gut, and then you know they produce lots of endotoxin.
Yep.
So this is another disease that can be really fatal and can kill a horse like in hours.
Yep.
And again, it's really important to try to pick up soon because you know you can treat a horse, but it's always timing. You know, you can
Yes.
call the vet, but if the situation is too
Too far
compromised,
gone.
yeah, so the vet can't, you know, we are not magician,
And I think that, we often have put them in, called them in a bit too late. So,
yeah, exactly. This another point really important, just the monitoring of the health after the trip. Little stuff,
yes.
you know, like the hydrational status, the temperature, stuff that each people can
Yep.
do. And you know, and exactly, and if something is not normal, then you call the vet, and the vet will be more than happy to save your horse and give you good advice. But if you call the vet when the horse is already lying down, or he has already a massive diarrhea, could be too late. You know that?
Yeah, exactly. So, all right, so those are some of the things that you've found. And what are some of the things then that you can already see that you've touched on quite a few, but some of the things that horse owners can do to work towards preventing some of these problems in transport?
I think first of all, like a good health check before the trip, in
Yep.
particular if you know you are going to move horses really interstate. I think
Yeah.
that also consultation from a vet could be helpful because some disease, as I told you, are subclinical and
Yeah.
they are difficult also for a vet. So probably you need a scoping to really see if there is something you know, in the respiratory tract, that is,
Yeah.
and so this I think it's an important point. And then,
So if you were to scope, what would you be scoping for?
it's just to see if there is already some mucus, or if there is
Yeah.
some, you know, bacteria, particular bacteria, or a virus, you know.
Yep.
Yeah,
Yep.
another problem is like related with transport stress, that some herpes virus then can show up.
Somewhat? What was that?
This a herpes virus.
Okay, herpes virus. Oh, so like equine herpes virus, you mean?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
So you
okay,
know, yeah, they can just you know, coming because these virus are usually latent in the animal, so they are there, but with the stress they show they can again become like active, and then they can induce like this rhinopneumonia, then could
Yeah.
be an easy basis then for the bacteria to become travel sickness.
Absolutely. Yeah. Equine, for listeners, equine herpes virus is something that often a lot of foals get, and it will sit there a bit like chicken pox in humans can sit latent in
Exactly.
the body and reappear at a later date. So usually horses that get a viral illness or a cold, that's the latent virus that's popping up. Yeah, so you can kind of detect those things if you do a good assessment before they leave.
And then, as we have told, it's important like to minimize the stress during the trip. And again, each horses can be different. So, you know, and it's really important that they have space enough. You know, we tend to put like in the same track, in the same space, different horses, but some horses are bigger, so they need one half space and not one. And it's important that they have space enough to load their head. So, from my point of view, it's just better if they are not high, and also because,
Yeah, so keeping their head lower is important, is that right?
it's a key
Yeah.
point. Yeah,
Yeah.
lower than the wither.
The withers.
Yeah,
Yep.
so better if they could really load the head until the floor. So I mean, if they have space enough and they are not high, they can do it. And then, you know, the neck is really important also for the balance. So
Yes.
if the horse cannot move his neck, it cannot really balance, so it can be fall easily.
So this is the other thing. I think a lot of people went for angle load floats a lot. And when I was thinking about this, it was one of the points that stopped me really following through on that kind of purchase because I could see that the horse's head was kind of squished,
Yeah, I
and they
feel.
can be pushing on their nose, and they didn't seem to have enough space to drop, particularly if it's a larger horse.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan of the backwards position. I have also done an experiment,
Right.
as already published. Yeah, and I found that actually horses travel better and have also less impact on the muscle system if they travel backwards.
Yes, well, and so I've had that situation where I've put horses in backwards, particularly if they've had limb injuries, like front limb injuries that I've been wanting to protect, and I'll bolster them around with hay bales so that I can really transport that horse very carefully if it needs to. Yeah.
Yeah, it's again, it's a balance and a biochemical, biomechanical
Yeah.
approach. So the Professor Sharon Krager has already demonstrated that in the 1978.
Long time ago.
Long
So it
time
takes us a
ago.
long time to get stuff, doesn't it?
Yeah, so, and I mean, you know, she has just done really biomechanical study, and you know, the horse has you know, all 60% of his weight on the foreleg, and
Yeah.
he balanced himself with the back legs. So I mean,
Yeah.
if you put like in the forward position and you know, just you break the car,
It breaks, yeah.
it tend to fall.
Yep,
In
yep.
instead, if he's in a backward position, he can just absorb the force, and
Yes.
then to absorb, actually, he has to lower his head. So, you know, you do two things with the same stuff. You
Yeah.
have lower head and better balance.
So can I just go back to the lower head? We have a habit of putting hay nets in our floats,
Yeah.
and they tend to be tied up high. So it would probably make sense that if you do have a hay net, what do you think about feeding on root and hay nets and those sorts of things?
I have not done really an experiment, so you know,
Yeah.
I can just tell you what I have read. It's still a
Yeah.
matter of debate if it's better, you know, give food and root. For sure, the worst that you can do is put hay in a net at the nostril level.
Yeah, so it's got to be lower.
Yeah, and also because I mean the problem with the hay is and sometimes there is dust or also
Yeah.
you know some fungi, and then if you put like at the nostril level and the horse cannot lower his head, then you just are putting all the dust and the fungi in his respiratory arteries.
Yeah, so yeah,
So the
so
best to like there are lots of work done by Dr. Lydon in Ireland. And
yeah.
he advised like damp the hay,
Yeah, that's what I do.
yeah, and actually put like on the floor.
If you're doing that, so just for listeners, what I tend to do with that is to put it in the very small hay net, so the what they call the slow feeder hay
Yeah,
nets, so they
I know,
can't get their foot caught in them, and just damp it down before you go and make sure there's no dust in your float.
yeah. So yeah, you know, because I got also some problem of choke related to transport stress.
Yep.
So this
Yep.
is why, you know, feeding could be a good practice, but you have to do like carefully, like damp the hay,
Yeah.
avoid that they took too much. I think that's really important also to give water. You know,
Yes.
horses usually, you know, don't eat if they don't have any way. Or the water,
To
and so could be also probably a way to prevent choke. But I told you, now I mean, I have lots of data and actually. I need more funding to
we
do.
Need more analysis on that stuff.
No, actually to do more experiment, but you know,
yeah,
applied
okay.
experiment, like to see, I mean, if I feed the horses or not, what is better? If after the trip I put the horses in a paddock, is it better than a box? You know, if
yeah.
I make him grazing for 1 hour after, is it better, you know? So by need,
yeah.
like do experiment to be sure what I'm speaking. And yeah, but the problem is also a bit, you know, now find some funding, you know.
And so how do you do that in a controlled way? And how do you do that with enough horses to make it a useful study? So
yeah, you know,
this
is why, I mean, I need funding. I mean, if we got like good funding, then we can do it. We can use research sources or, you know, people who are happy to let me check their horses during trips, you know, and then
yeah.
you always have to need an experimental protocol with control and, you know, so building a
way. Do you know what? I was listening to a TED talk on collaborative and on open sourcing, and this might be a study that you could collaborate, because I know that I would be more than happy to assist with that, and you might be able to work with the truck owners, truck companies, to get other people so that you kind of duplicate you, so that you say, this is the protocol we use, now do this test, record it, blah 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 blah. So
oh,
that might be something
nice.
To think about.
Yeah mm-hmm. yeah, then send me like some info about it. Yeah, I would appreciate
yeah.
it. Yeah, it's yeah, and again, and I think, you know, it's a common problem, and we can
it
solve
is.
The problem only if we work together.
Yep, absolutely. So very, very good point. So we've talked about keeping them stressed. We've talked a little bit about, so I guess the theory going back to the feeding is that I've sort of weighed up over time. I used to do quite a few long trips across to Adelaide, which is in the scheme of things not that long. It's about 8 hours.
Mm-hmm.
And the way that we would do that is with the horse, and we would stop every 2 hours and give them a rest. If there was grazing, we would let them graze. And then we would, and give them water every 2 hours and get them there. And they all seem to arrive pretty okay. But as I said, it's sort of, and I kind of weighed up the feeding thing saying, well, horses need a continuous gut movement.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure about whether that's right or not.
Yeah, I mean, so far, this is like the European Union guideline. It is a kind like give food and water every 4 hours.
Right, okay, yeah.
So, you know, it's no longer, it's like this is the guideline in Europe for long
time. Okay.
Yeah, so probably
well,
two,
too.
Yeah, 2 hours, you know, the problem is you tend to really extend the structure.
The whole
trip,
yeah.
Probably too much. You know, there is like another philosophy that try to actually make the trip shorter as possible, but make actually, you know, like the track really comfortable.
Very
so
comfortable.
It is like instead of just base, have like a kind of little box so that they can move in
and lie down,
they can eat and they can drink, you know, on the road, and then at the end of the day, so you avoid like resting, spelling the and stopping, loading, because at the time it's the problem is that every loading is anyway a kind of you know, stress, and then at the first hour usually of the trip is the more stressful, so you know.
So
I mean, this is why it's a bit tricky.
And it is. And when I was in America, I noticed that they do have like boxes.
Yeah.
And that a lot of the, because America is again very big. Mm-hmm. So the people that I was there with, they had one lady particularly. I did love what she put on her horse. He looked all this protective gear over his head, but she actually let her horse, she just had hay on the ground dampened down, and he could actually lie down in that float
yep.
and move around. She didn't tie him up. He just kind of was in there.
Yeah, there are stories of horses, and also one of my horses, you know, we had actually to have a really important race, and we make him just, you know, all these little van just for him with full, you know, of bedding and stuff. We travel overnight, and he was just, you know, really sleeping in the truck. And then, you know, when we arrive at the racetrack, he was fit, and, you know, yeah, he has won, you know. So I think it's, again, I really think it's the way how we manage transport that can make the difference. This is, I mean, my philosophy. And then, just to highlight, because we probably, I don't want to forget, it's really important to monitor after the trip, you know?
Yes. So
just in particular, if the horses have traveled, like, longer than, let's say, 12 hours, you need to keep an eye.
How long would you continue to monitor the horse for?
Also for five days.
5 days. Okay, yeah, that's a really good piece of advice.
Little stuff like just taking in temperature, morning and afternoon, and then just looking if they are drinking and eating normally, you know, if the feces are normal. And because the problem with this, like travel sickness or enterocolitis, is that they start usually 2 days or 3 days after the trip.
Right. Yeah. So, okay. So that's a really good bit of advice. And I think for listeners, I have on my website, equinecareclinic.com, a blog post on how to take your horse's OBS. And I've also got a chart there people can download to monitor it. So if you're interested in that or you don't know how to do it, go ahead. It's really simple.
I will have a look. I mean, as a vet, I can monitor horses, but
yes, yeah. But see, it's a lot of people. We do workshops where we teach people this and other things, but it's really the basics.
Basic stuff, you know, exactly. Yeah. You don't need to be a vet, but just something more than have a look. Because the problem, you know, it then sometimes I got some clients. They just told me, I look at the horse was, you know, like less active, but I thought, you know, it was tired. Instead he had fever, you know, was not tired.
Exactly.
So, you know, little stuff, and that everyone can do, you know.
Yep, that's my philosophy too. So, so that's been a really great lot of information, and I can't wait to see your findings. In fact, I'm going to get you back then when you've got some of these, you know, when you're releasing your articles. I'd really love to have you back to talk about what else you've found out.
One article is going to be published like this week, and there are
fantastic. Where's that going to be published?
A journalist called Animals, but it's an open access, so each people can download.
Fantastic.
I will send you the link, so if you want.
If you send me the link and I'll put that on with the show notes, that'd be fantastic. All right, that's great, Barbara. So if there's a couple of key messages you would like to leave the listeners with, what would they be?
Monitor the horses before, during and after the trip is the best way to make the horse safe and avoid really important disease. And minimize all the stressing during the trip and ask advice. You know, I'm happy if people want to contact me, and, you know, I'm more than happy to go to do like kind of workshop and, you know, just educate people. I'm here and I'm in Australia, I think, for the next 1.5 years. So just try to use me.
Well, that's fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I know the listeners are going to get heaps and heaps out of this interview. So it's been really great talking to you. Thanks very much, and bye-bye. Have a great day.
The same. Thanks for hosting me. Bye.
I'm so pleased I got to talk to Barbara today, and what an absolute horse in gold. Some pearls of wisdom that I took away are, number one, take the time to train your horse to be calm in the float or truck. You want them to be happy in there. It's something that's going to make a huge difference to the health of your horse and probably to you too. There's nothing more stressful than transporting unhappy horses, and we've all had that experience, I'm sure. Number two, make sure your horse is healthy before he travels. Learn to take his vital signs, particularly the temperature. Anything not right with the horse before travel is only going to get worse and can potentially be fatal. And number three, after long haul travel, make sure you monitor your horse for 5 days after arrival home and get the vet to check out any abnormal signs promptly. So let me know what you took away from this discussion. You can leave a comment on iTunes or on the show notes at horsesenseshow.com. For more great horse tips, follow me on our Facebook page at the Equine Care Clinic. Until next time, may your horsing be great horsing, and goodbye.